Hello, and welcome to the Rooted in Reliability podcast, your plant performance podcast, where we dive deeper into asset management techniques and know-how. I'm your host, James Kovacic, and I will be your guide to achieving industry best practice. The Rooted in Reliability podcast is here to provide you with the insights to improve plant performance and deliver bottom-line results to your organization. In case you missed the last episode, you can find the Rooted in Reliability podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and on the reliability.fm network. Don't forget to subscribe so you'll never miss an episode. Now let's dive into today's topic.
It is my pleasure to welcome Ron Moore to the podcast. Welcome, Ron.
Thank you.
So for those that may not be familiar with Ron, you are the managing partner at DRM Group. You're an authority on strategies and practices for operational excellence, maintenance, and reliability programs. You're also an author of numerous books, Making Common Sense Common Practice, one of my personal favorites, What Tool When, Where Do We Start Our Improvement Journey, and a few others. You're also an author and keynote speaker. I've had the opportunity to listen to a few of your keynotes, and they're always great. So welcome. And can you fill in anything that I may have missed from your introduction?
Well, I mean, I think that's enough, given all the things we've got to cover. I might add that prior to this, doing the consulting shtick, I was president of CSI, the folks that make the condition monitoring equipment, equipment and software, instruments and software. And before that, I worked on nuclear submarines and power stations. So I've been around for a long time at this point.
So you're another one of the nuclear Navy individuals that have learned how to do maintenance properly there and taken that to the industrial side of things?
Well, I'm not nuclear Navy per se. I worked at Electric Boat, and we designed and built nuclear submarines for the nuclear Navy. So you get a lot of that mindset rubs off on you.
And oh, absolutely.
Standards, discipline, good practice. And although we didn't call it reliability, it was clear that we expected, demanded, and provided high reliability in submarines.
Absolutely. Now, how long have you been involved in maintenance and reliability?
Well, formally or more officially, something on the order of 30 years. I joined CSI as its president in 1988. And, of course, they were sole predictive maintenance tools, condition monitoring tools. And so that would make it about 30 years. But as I mentioned earlier, when you work on nuclear submarines and power stations, high reliability is paramount. So you might say it's closer to 40 years, but it's been a long time.
Absolutely. But you're bringing that wealth of experience. So with that, I wanted to talk about reliability today. So what do you think is the best way for the maintenance community, reliability community, to explain the importance of reliability to those senior executives, those organizational leaders that need to support these initiatives?
Well, they're two or three thoughts on that. One is show me the money. And I think far too often we forget that. Reliability in most organizations would be worth, in large organizations, say $1 billion company, would probably be worth $100 million, which is pretty significant. And it certainly gets their attention. The other thing, though, I think is safety. Most of these organizations say that safety is their top priority. Well, when you walk around their plants, it's not obvious because they have, clearly, many of them have poor practices, poor reliability, and so on. And I've got a wealth of data that says if you don't have good reliability, then you are less likely to have good safety and less likely to have low costs and less likely to have better quality and less likely to have good environmental performance. So reliability is really the foundation of operational excellence and all those other good things that come with it. And most organizations, although they say safety is a top priority, their actual practices belie that statement. The other thing I'd say is that reliability is not just about maintenance. Of course, you have to have a good maintenance program to have good reliability. But if that's all you do, you'll only do more efficiently work you shouldn't be doing at all. And so it requires a comprehensive approach, design, procurement, operations, and maintenance. And the analogy that I use is expecting maintenance to deliver reliability is like expecting the mechanic at the garage to make your car reliable. Of course, they support it. But if you don't drive your car properly, if you don't take care of it, if you don't get its PMs done in a timely way and so on and do proper condition monitoring, it's really difficult for it to be reliable.
Yes, absolutely. So it really is that holistic approach when it comes to maintenance and reliability. And it's linking it to safety with quality, with environmental, like you said. But then also all the users are of that of those assets, whether it's operations running it, whether it's engineering and procurement in the design phase and procurement phases. Everyone needs to be involved for it to be effective within that organization.
Yeah, and it's really about defect elimination. Eliminate the defects, that is the process errors or the design flaws or the fabrication or installation or startup or whatever it may be. Eliminate those things that result in defects within the equipment and within the processes in order for you to be truly effective. And maintenance is at the tail end of that string of processes. And if you don't do the ones upstream properly, maintenance can't possibly keep up with all the problems. They'll just be overwhelmed.
Yes, absolutely. Now, you know, I've had the opportunity to work on implementing maintenance and reliability programs across different countries, different regions. Have you noticed a difference from a global to a regional perspective when it comes to reliability? Are global approaches different than regional approaches within organizations?
I think in my experience, they have more similarities than they have differences. Just a couple of differences I might mention in Asia, in Indonesia, Malaysia, China, and so on, they tend to be more siloed and more hierarchical and, less free flow of information. You know, if the boss says it, then that's the way it'll be. And each silo tends to operate even more independently than do those in the Western European, U.S. Countries. So that would be one difference. That said, though, that means they get pretty good in each functional area, but probably need more communication, as we all do, across functional boundaries. In Australia, where I spend a lot of time, there seems to be more attention paid to reliability by executives, senior level leadership, than I've seen in the U.S. And you could go, probably country by country. In Germany, they tend to be, they fit the stereotypical German pattern, precision engineering, discipline, and so on. So there are minor differences, but in most countries, maintenance is not held in high regard, not held in high esteem, and therefore it's not given as much resource, attention, and so on. And I think that's fundamentally because when most executives think of maintenance, their emotional response or reaction to that phrase is costs and downtime. And they generally don't want any more of that. And therefore, they have a negative emotional response to it. What they want is lower costs. And many of them think they can get lower costs and better performance by simply cutting those costs, when the real solution is to eliminate the defects and improve the processes upstream, which would then allow maintenance more time to do a proper job and to have lower costs. So that's probably enough said on that point.
Absolutely. Now, have you noticed how, personally, I've experienced certain regions where if it's not invented here, we don't want it. Have you noticed that across different geographical regions, and how has that impacted organizations looking to implement a global maintenance and reliability program?
Well, I think that has more to do it's kind of inherent in individuals across the globe. If I'm at my job and I'm doing my best to do a good job, and somebody from a corporate headquarters comes in to instruct me on how to do it better, there's a bit of a reluctance to embrace that. And a lot of times, so I don't think it's so much culturally different across these countries so much as it is individuals wanting a little bit of autonomy and independence and wanting really to be proud of what they do. What I see a lot of times is what I call seagull, corporate seagulls. They swoop, poop, and squawk. And very often it leaves the guys on the floor or at the plant feeling put upon. And so if the corporate guys are coming in to help, they need to endear themselves to the guys on the floor and demonstrate how they can help make their life easier and make their problems fewer, reduce the number of problems, and make them less onerous, less impactful. So,
yes, absolutely.
There are differences. On the other hand, I think those differences are inherent within most people across the globe.
Yeah, absolutely. Corporate reliability groups, they have to be effective. They have to be assisting. Like you said, they can't come in, drop some standards, give a couple of days strain, then run away for 6 to 9 or 12 months. That's not effective.
They have to become part of the solution and part of the team solving the problems, and they have to be viewed as strong proponents, strong advocates, and helpers in solving those problems. But the swoop, poop, squawk approach is actually detrimental. You'd be better off without it.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. Now, with that, if you could give one piece of advice to an organization that's just starting out on its journey, what would it be?
Well, it might not be just one. The things that I've seen that work are, number one, you've got to have executive sponsorship. And that doesn't just mean permission. I give you permission and send you off. The executives have to talk about it, articulate a strategy, provide the resources. They have to demand it. They have to support it. They have to reward it. They have to punish it. In other words, just like safety, they have to be actively engaged in supporting the entire, holistic, comprehensive process for reliability. And it's not just maintenance. The second thing would be it has to be production-led. Too often, I see reliability programs driven by maintenance. And maintenance can contribute, but if you don't stop the defects upstream, maintenance will be at a severe disadvantage. They'll be, the old phrase goes, they'll be pushing on a rope, and they'll be overwhelmed by the defects coming in from upstream. So the places where I've seen have high reliability, it's generally production-led with maintenance, a strong support function, with all the appropriate processes in place there as well. And the last thing is do the basics well. Have standard work and set high standards. The high standard the lowest standard you set is the highest standard you can expect. So, you mentioned earlier about being in plants where it was obvious that they were really good and in other plants where they weren't. Well, in my view, that's a failure in the leadership of that plant to set high standards. And to support them, not just demand, but also support with resources and tools and time and so on. So,
yes.
Doing the basics well, I think, is right up there in the, at the top of the list.
Yeah.
So those
do
three
the basics.
Things.
You can say do the basics well. Make sure you have executive support and make sure it's production led. And the majority of programs I see are not production led. They're maintenance led because they're sick of production yelling at them. And that isn't the right way to do it. You need to have production-led because they operate the equipment every day. How they operate it definitely has an impact on reliability. What they demand of the equipment from engineering influences it. There's all these things that come together. So I couldn't agree more. Having a production-led is vitally important.
Well, the other thing you'll find that I've found, and it's with rare exception, when you measure the overall equipment effectiveness, an OEE measure, what you find is that of the losses from ideal, typically 2/3 of those have nothing to do with the equipment. It's product changeovers, it's raw material, it's short stops, it's rate and quality, it's just a plethora of issues. Of the 1/3 that is, in fact, equipment related, generally speaking, the majority, in fact, something like 2/3 of those equipment failures are because of poor operating practice or poor design. And so maintenance only controls about 10% of the production losses. You know, let's say your OEE is 70%, and so you got 30% losses. Maintenance only has direct control of about 3% of those production losses. So having them try to drive, minimize those losses is pretty silly. You
know? Yes.
Now everybody needs to look at their own data to see how they, you know, what that looks like for them, and then just make decisions accordingly. But that's what I typically see.
Now, going back to your first piece, getting that executive support, which is absolutely vital, and like you said, active support. How can our listeners go ahead and get that active support? Is it, you know, sharing some case studies? Is it bringing in someone such as yourself? Or is it taking, you know, your book, Making Common Sense Common Practice, and dropping it on a few senior executives' desks? What is the best approach to gaining their support?
Well, I wouldn't drop a copy of my book on their desk because they wouldn't read it. So, but you know, at the risk of, you know, proselytizing a bit, I'd be happy to come in and spend a half a day with their executives and explain it to them. But I think, forgetting about that for a minute, I think the way that I have tried to approach this when I do have those meetings with executives, and I've had several, is I start out with, you know, where's the money? And so let's just do a really quick example. Let's suppose you're, a $10 billion a year company, and you can proportion these numbers according to your own judgment, and you're spending, let's say, $1 billion a year on maintenance. This would be like a heavy petrochemical, chemical, steel, you know, one of those heavy industries. Then it would be fairly common for you to be able to reduce, not cut, but reduce in a sustainable way your maintenance costs by about 10%. Well, that's $100 million. And beyond that, you get additional capacity, something on the order of 5 to 10% increase in your OEE. Well, that's additional capacity. It doesn't require additional capital investment. And if you could sell all that strategically over the next 5 years, if you could fill in that capacity, that's probably worth another $200 or $300 million in gross profit. So, you know, step one is to articulate the prospective business case. And then step two is to outline a process by which you can achieve that over the next 3 to 5 years. I know I was in Quebec City or near there one time at an operation. And the first slide I had up on the presentation for the president and a bunch of vice presidents and site managers was 100. The slide was 150,000,000, $150 million. And I had their attention. And so from that point, you articulate, where does that number come from? How do you capture, you know, that additional gross profit contribution? And then you articulate what's required of them in order to support that. And when you do that, you know, generally they're very receptive. So, and I think you throw in a case study here and there, and you bring data that substantiates the business case. By the way, I'll send you a keynote with some of this data in it when we're finished talking here.
All right, excellent.
And you can share it with anybody that wants it.
All right, perfect. We'll make sure to include a link to that within the show notes so people can access it right away.
Okay.
Excellent. Now, with that data, you know, I remember seeing through one of your keynotes, and it talked about the specifically not only the financial impact on the business, but the link between reliability, safety, quality, environmental performance. How important is that in convincing the executives that, you know, this is the right way to go? And then what evidence do you have to support those linkages?
Yeah, well, much of that will be in the set of data I send you, but just let me just give you a quick snapshot of it. I've got now about 6 or 7 sets of data that show that there's an inverse relationship between reliability and injury rate or safety as determined by the OEE measure. That is, as OEE improves, injury rate goes down. And, you know, the data comes from chemicals, pulp and paper, steel, food, and a couple others that I don't remember off the top of my head. So it's a fairly consistent set of data that says as your operating performance improves, your injury rate goes down. Well, to me, that just makes a lot of sense because you have less exposure to the risk of injury because your plant is running well. It's steady. It's stable. And I've got some data from a large corporation wherein as their reliability improves, their costs drop fairly substantially. And I've got data on just some simple things like planning and schedules, maintenance schedule compliance. As your maintenance schedule compliance improves, injury rate goes down. Well, you're not reacting to all these unscheduled, unplanned events. And at times, taking shortcuts, taking risks, you know, it's just a much riskier environment when you're reacting to a situation instead of operating in a controlled manner. And
yes,
I've got
absolutely.
Some data on environmental stuff. Now, I don't have so much data on product quality, but I would submit to you that if you're having frequent upsets in your processes, your product quality will suffer. There's no question in my mind about that, although I don't have specific detailed data on that.
Yeah, I would agree as well, because your process is not stable. You're introducing all these different variations, and with those variations come a inherent risk to variances in the product quality as well.
I've seen that time and again.
Yes, absolutely. Now, at this point, say we have our executive support and we're looking at what do we do next. What are your thoughts on, do we start with technology? Do we look at predictive maintenance systems, CMMS, so on and so forth, or do we focus on the processes, work planning, work control, spares management? You know, where's the best place to start?
Well, I think those are important, and I certainly think you should have those tools, those capabilities at your disposal. But in parallel with that, or as a part of that whole approach, I would focus on the basics. So I would be doing things like 5S, 5Ys, standard work, visual systems, structured improvement time. I mean, one of the best ways that I have seen to improve performance and get a shift in the culture of an organization is to, just for example, pick a machine or pick an area. You know, it might be a pumping station or a compressor station or, you know, a conveyor. Shoot, it could be almost anything. Pick something, put together a cross-functional team, and go clean it. And you might say, well, clean it? Why do you do that? Well, you clean it. When you clean it, you get close to it, and when you get close to it, you find defects. You find loose connections. You find loose bolts. You find things that haven't been, you know, calibrated in weeks. You find stuff that you can correct, and after you correct that, the system will work better. And then you put in processes to keep it that way, procedures, standards, checklists, pictures, and so on. And when you get that one done, you pick another one, and you go get that one right. And you just keep working your way through the entire plant until you've got them all done. And at that point, you'll have to go back and do some of the earlier ones again, because they will tend to deteriorate a little bit with time. And when you do that, I've found that you get a change in the culture. People expect to have to go and work together to achieve a common purpose. And then they expect everybody around them will sustain that. And when you do that, you eliminate a lot of defects. You eliminate a lot of problems. And when you do that, you make all these other tools, the work management, the planning and scheduling, the condition monitoring, you make that so much more, well, easy and effective because Yes. You've got the organizational discipline, the organizational readiness in place, and you've eliminated a lot of those problems that tend to overwhelm those things, like planning and scheduling, that don't allow it to happen if that process is overwhelmed by all those defects. So that's, the technology is important. Certainly you should have it. But if you don't have the basics in place, the technology is probably not going to help you very much.
This podcast is brought to you by Iridicio. Be sure to check out iridicio.com for a free copy of their ebook, A Smarter Way of Preventative Maintenance. This ebook will allow you to review your current maintenance program and eliminate the non-value-added work you are doing, which is most likely causing you more downtime than it is preventing. www.iridicio.com.
Yeah, so start with the people, get the culture in place, the practices, the expectations, the standards in place. And then once we're starting to realize those benefits, it'll free up a little bit of time to work on, you know, fixing the CMMS, getting vibration in, and we'll also have the discipline to use that effectively, correct?
Yeah, that's right.
Now, as we're doing this, we should be monitoring performance. So what metrics do you suggest to monitor the implementation of maintenance and reliability programs? And how do we determine which ones we should use? You mentioned OEE previously. That's a great one for how the site does. But should we be breaking that down further, or should everyone be using OEE?
Well, I think everybody should be using OEE, unless you're a facility like a school or a hospital or, you know, one of those things. But, yeah, now, there's a broad misconception about OEE, and that is, you know, there are numbers out there that say, well, 85% OEE, that's world class. Well, that's the wrong focus. The focus ought to be on managing the losses. And those losses ought to be broken down into categories that are reflective of the business needs. And what I mean by that is you should measure scheduled and unscheduled downtime, rate and quality losses. You should also perhaps measure other losses that are significant to the business, things like insufficient utilities or raw material disruptions or supply chain disruptions. And the focus is to manage the losses. It is not any particular number like 80 or 90 or 60 or whatever it may be. The point being, if you manage the losses, then the number will be what it's supposed to be according to the business requirements. So, let me just give you an example. I did a workshop for the VP of manufacturing and his seven plant managers one time. And at the end, he said, all right, you guys, you're going to be at 85% OEE in 2 years. Is that clear? And everybody nodded, of course. They're not going to disagree with the boss when he makes a mandate, usually. And I pulled him aside at the break, and I said, Jeff, you just screwed up, buddy. He said, what do you mean? You told me world class is 85. I want to be that. I said, yeah, but, you know, this guy over here, he only makes two products. And he's an upstream supplier to all the downstream plants. He ought to be at 92%. And one of the guys downstream, he makes 200 different products, and they all have shelf lives. He's probably never going to get above 80. So in one case, you know, you've cut him a lot of slack. In another case, he'll never achieve it. And, of course, the point being, you've got to focus on what the losses are and make business decisions on how you manage those losses. So that's the big one for me. Now, within each of those measures, there are sub-measures that are related. So there ought to be some, you know, some measures there. And certainly, I think production schedule compliance, maintenance schedule compliance ought to be in there. But I would make the production and maintenance managers both responsible for production and maintenance schedule compliance. Because too often they point the finger at one another and blame one another when really the business suffers when either one of those isn't addressed appropriately.
Yes,
go ahead.
I was at a organization that did just that. So their maintenance schedule compliance was owned by the operations group because the operations group was in charge of giving up those assets to do the maintenance or not. And they did very, very well in getting high maintenance schedule compliance, high production schedule compliance, because they were working together and not fighting each other nonstop. And you know, at first I found it a little confusing why they would do that. It's maintenance, why does operations own it? But after I saw it working, it made perfect sense. And that, you know, those sites made huge headway in their ability to work together as a group, to prioritize work properly, to do all these things, because they had that shared responsibility.
Right. And on that particular topic, another example would be I would make the procurement manager, who typically runs stores these days, and the maintenance manager both responsible for stock out rate, and for inventory levels, inventory turns. Those are conflicting measures, and if you have stock levels in the hands of procurement and stock outs in the hands of maintenance, you're always going to be at odds with one another, and you're less likely to make those compromises that are for the better, you know, for the greater good of the business. So there needs to be some sharing of measures across functional boundaries such that it facilitates cooperation and teamwork and greater business purpose. So that's another principle that I would suggest is really, really important. Another measure would be unit cost. You know, that's an indicator of what kind of gross profit I'm making in certain market conditions. And then beyond those two, and those are two big ones, OEE and unit cost, but sub-measures associated with each of those, and having cross-functional measures that are shared, I would have a good healthy dose of leading indicators. Now, these are things that the shop floor does. You know, it's things like an operating level process conformance, operator care, spills, housekeeping, you know, those kinds of things. And at a maintenance level, things like, you know, PM compliance, number of seals or bearings used per month, number of steam and water leaks, you know, those kinds of things. These are things that are in direct control of the people on the floor. And, you know, I would say if those are improving, if that is, if we do the right things will happen, and all the lagging indicators, you know, the OEE and so on, those will, you know, by necessity get better, because we're doing the right things. So the right things will happen. So there needs to be greater emphasis on the leading indicators, on engaging the workforce and doing all the little things right on a day-to-day basis. So,
those leading metrics for the frontline workforce, it has to be something they can influence themselves. It's not a very high-level metric that, you know, what they do on a day-to-day basis, they can't see it. The changes are reflected in that KPI. It has to be something they can actually influence and measure on a day-to-day or shift-by-shift basis, correct?
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely.
Perfect. Now, you wrote a great book about tools. What are your favorite tools, and when should you use them? I know you mentioned 5S, standard work, and if it's those ones again, perfect. But are there any others too that you want to mention?
Well, the details are in the book, What Tool When. It's a management guide. I would like to say this, before you even get to the tools, there are prerequisites, leadership, alignment, teamwork, a high performance culture, and those kinds of things. Because if you have that, just about any tool will work. If you don't have that, no tool will work. The Harvard Business Review published a study one time about the tools, and they concluded that the performance wasn't related to any particular tool. And that's what I found as well. It's about leadership, alignment, teamwork, culture, those kinds of things. But now, with that said, what I found works best is what I discussed earlier, and that is it's a toolbox of tools. It's Kaizen. It's called Kaizen anyways. But it's 5S, 5Ys, standard work, visual systems, you know, those kinds of things, quick changeover. Those are the organizational enablers. They create the organizational discipline. They solve a lot of problems. From there, I would use OEE, operator care, PDM, planning and scheduling, those kinds of things, you know, that are in the so-called TPM bucket. And by the way, TPM should be called total productive manufacturing, not maintenance, because it's more about, you know, getting the right processes in place, taking care of the equipment at a production level, plus the maintenance, the training, and building or designing the equipment so that you minimize the risk of defects. And if you have a proper take on TPM, you'll know that. And then from there, I think you go to, you know, RCM, RCA, Six Sigma, you know, the more advanced tools. Now, I'm not saying you don't need those advanced tools. Certainly you do. But if you want to sustain the benefit of those tools, you better get the basics in place first. And that that will, besides solving problems, it'll also make those results from those sustainable. The other thing that I found is when I go to operations and they have, say, an RCM or an RCA process, only maybe 3 or 4% of the workforce is involved in that. Well, what about the other 96, 97%? What are you doing to engage them? Because that's where the opportunity is. That's where the leverage is. So I think it takes a good mix of all those, but I would start with the basics, then go to TPM principles, and then have my RCM, RCA, Six Sigma process. And if Five Whys doesn't work for you, then drop down and use a more sophisticated RCA methodology. Or if standard work doesn't reduce the variability, drop down and use Six Sigma. You know, I'm not saying you don't need those tools. I'm saying apply those tools in a hierarchy that allows them to be as effective as possible while still engaging all of the workforce in defect elimination and process improvement.
Yes, makes perfect sense. So where a 5Y will work, let's get the majority of people trained in 5Ys and use those. And then, if we need to dive down and use a different tool, then we do that. But use the most effective tool, I guess, for the specific situation. We can engage most of the staff.
Yeah, you want to engage the workforce, because what the data say is that only about 30% of the workforce in a typical operation is actually engaged. 50% are not engaged, and 20% are actively disengaged. You know, they're trying to foment difficulty. So if you can engage, you know, if you could double 30 to 60, man, that would be a huge improvement in, you know, workforce engagement and therefore in productivity and process improvement.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
It would mitigate all those others.
Yes, yes, it would. We might actually be able to pull some of those actively disengaged people to, maybe not actively disengaged, but pull them into that middle group so
yep.
They're not actively working against us. And then it makes everything a bit easier.
Yep. Yep.
Excellent. Now, you mentioned, you know, using RCM as for an example. How important is it in the understanding of failure modes, failure mechanisms, and operating context in developing a reliability program? Do they need to understand that, or is that something that comes over time and we don't have to worry about it up front?
Well, I wouldn't worry so much about it up front. I think it will evolve as people begin to understand how things failed as they do the basics well. Because in doing that, in doing the, you know, the five whys and the standard work, they'll begin, and working together to understand what each other does and how they do it, they'll begin to understand failure modes, either implicitly or explicitly. But with that said, I think there needs to be a function within the organization that actually goes into some depth on failure modes and mechanisms, operating context. And then they use that information to feed back into the guys who are operating and maintaining the plant so that they have a better understanding of those mechanisms and can take appropriate action in the way they operate and maintain so as to mitigate and minimize the risk of those things happening. So I think it's important, but I don't think it's so important to try to educate all the workforce about RCM and failure modes. I think it's more important that you get them actively involved in solving the little niggly problems that they come across every day.
Yeah, absolutely. It's all about, you know, making sure that, like you said, we're doing the basics right, and then we can learn and evolve as we go. Now, one of the common things I hear is, you know, you can't rely on manufacturer recommendations for PM routines. Why can't organizations do that, or can they?
Well, I think they should certainly consider manufacturer recommendations, but what I've seen, a friend of mine over in Australia, he's done some work on this, and what he's found is that, you know, manufacturer PM recommendations apply. You know, you can absolutely use them exactly as is, maybe 30 to 40% of the time. And then the other times, maybe you don't need them, maybe you need a new task. And the fundamental problem, I think, is that manufacturers have a very natural bias towards selling you more and therefore over-recommending. And that's not to say that they're dishonest or even wrong. is just to say that they have that natural bias towards that. The second problem is they very often don't understand your operating context. You know, you can have two identical pieces of equipment which are operated very differently and therefore require very different operating and maintenance strategies. So unless those are brought into play, then the their recommendations may not be sufficient to optimize performance of the equipment.
Yes, absolutely. So we have to take, if we're going to use the manufacturer recommendations, we take those, we look at them in light of our operating context, how we're using the assets, where they're being used, and tweak them for what works best for us.
Yes, that's correct.
Excellent. All right. Now, if we have a plant that has implemented a basic reliability program, so maybe they're using those manufacturer recommendations, maybe they have some predictive maintenance tools, maybe they have some of these basic care activities in place, like 5S or standard work. What considerations or ideas would you give them about setting up an asset management program? So not just focused on the maintenance reliability piece, but the holistic use of that asset.
Well, what I've seen in most asset management strategies or plans or programs is it's a maintenance management strategy or plan that's been relabeled as an asset management plan. And I think that's insufficient. The first, if I'm the boss, the CEO or VP of manufacturing or even site manager, my question would be, what's expected of those assets over the next 5 to 10 years? Are we in a growth mode? Are we in a stable mode? Are we in a declining mode? Because I don't know how you can create an asset management plan when you don't know what's expected of the assets by the business in the future. So I would start there. The next question I would ask is, how are we currently performing relative to those expectations? That is, what's production's role in eliminating the losses from ideal such that we achieve those objectives with minimal additional capital and or costs? So what's production's role? Next question I would ask would be, well, what's procurement's role? Are they going to apply a total cost of ownership approach to business, or are they going to apply a installed price? And likewise for engineering relative to additional capital, are they going to apply a life cycle, or are they going to apply lowest installed cost? And then I would go to the maintenance piece and address the maintenance requirements in terms of how we're going to maintain those assets. And I would work really hard to make this the asset management strategy more akin to a business management strategy, because the assets typically are, it's capital intensive. Therefore, they are an integral part of the business plan. And I would make it much more broad in scope to address the business requirements.
Absolutely. So it's, it's talking with marketing and, production planning. What is our anticipated demand 1 year, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years down the road? Are we going to be going up? Are we going to be going down? Once we understand that, then understanding what our current state is. Are we meeting our performance measures? What opportunities do we have? And kind of building it out that way. So like you said, it's a way we're going to operate the business, not just how we're going to maintain these assets.
Right. And again, remember, most of the maintenance requirements are induced by poor operating practices and poor engineering and design. So if you just focus on maintenance, you're probably not going to achieve what you hope.
No, absolutely not. Now, Ron, as we progress through this, I always ask the same sort of questions towards the end of it. And before we do, one other key question for you is, do you have any other thoughts on reliability you want to share with our listeners? Is there anything we didn't cover that you think they need to consider, or so on and so forth?
Well, I think I've alluded to these things over the course of it, but I want to emphasize the point. Reliability is not just about maintenance. Reliability is about good design, procurement, operations, and maintenance working collectively to a common purpose with some shared measures and having leadership that does, supports, drives, demands, expects, measures, rewards, is actively engaged in it. And the primary focus of those functional areas working together is to eliminate the defects that result in bad things happening. So, you know, that sort of overarching philosophy, I think, is paramount. And again,
yes.
If all you do is good maintenance, you'll only do more efficiently work you ought not do in the first place, and you'll not achieve the results that you were expecting.
Yes, absolutely. That holistic approach, let's focus on the biggest losses, not just the one maintenance controls. Excellent. Now, what is the one thing that you think makes the biggest difference in a successful reliability program?
Well, I think there are two or three, and I talked about these early on. The first is executive sponsorship, and I've said that several times now. And I'll use the example of that you alluded to before we started the podcast of two plants, you know, similar requirements, technology, and whatever. And one was really good and one was not so good. Well, the one that was not so good had poor leadership, in my mind, without question. They didn't set high standards and high expectations and provide the support for that. So executive sponsorship, being production-led with a strong maintenance support component, and a process for shop floor engagement. If you do those three, and then tie in some KPIs and leading and lagging indicators, you have a very high probability of success.
Excellent. And that is a good recipe for our listeners to follow. Make sure you do those three things and you're setting yourself up for success long term. Now,
I've seen it work. I know it works. Okay. So,
excellent.
And when you miss in any one of those, is you increase the probability of failure dramatically.
Yeah, so you can't just do two of them. You need all three of those in place to be successful.
That's correct. That's right.
Now, if you had a magic wand, what is the one thing you would change regarding many of the reliability programs you have seen?
It would be production-led, period.
Simple enough. Make sure it's led by production. Make sure they're driving it. And, you know, we're support maintenance and the maintenance group is supporting it appropriately, but it needs to be production-led.
Yep.
No. What is the one action you want our listeners to take away regarding reliability from this conversation? What is the one thing you want them to do differently tomorrow when they listen to this?
Well, I don't know if there's one thing, but certainly, you know, we just said it, it's got to be production-led. There has to be a business case. There's got to be a process for employee engagement, and you got to have executive sponsorship. I don't know if there's any one thing that they could do tomorrow. But those three things need to be given, you know, a very high degree of energy, focus, drive, and so on.
Yes, excellent. The one thing I would recommend is if, you know, our listeners are still trying to put together the linkage between operations-led, the impact of marketing and forecasted demand and all those things, they're trying to understand those linkages, is making common sense common practice. Pick up a copy of that book. Read it. It's a journey talking about how this organization went through these changes, how you incorporate the marketing and finance aspects, what role does engineering and procurement play. It's a great book to show you how all these tie together to deliver business performance. So my one action would be, you know, if you haven't read that book, pick up a copy, read it, get an understanding of what Ron means by production-led, you know, the holistic approach, you know, that sort of thing.
Well, I appreciate the plug. That book is best taken in small doses. As you know, if you've read it, it's not an easy read. It takes time and requires a certain amount of reflection and absorption. So
yes.
It's not a pill you can take and be better. It's like getting back in shape after you haven't worked out in a year. It takes 6 months or a year to, you know, restore yourself.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. But it does a great job of tying all those together, which is why I'm a big fan of that particular book, because it does tie in all those aspects. Now, Ron, where can people find out more about you? Are you going to be at any conferences? Are you going to be presenting any papers anywhere? What are you actively involved with at the moment?
Not much. I don't have any immediate plans for any public presentations, conferences, or anything. I don't have a website. I don't do Facebook. I don't do LinkedIn. I don't Twitter. I don't, you know, do Instagram or whatever the hell that is. I don't even carry a business card, but I'd be happy to talk to people, respond to email. My phone number is 865-675-7647, and my email is ronsrmgp@aol.com. But I do what's called stealth marketing. You know, you have to find me first.
All right, excellent. Well, I'll make sure to put those in the show notes. So if our listeners do want to get in touch with you, have you come to their organization and work with their executive leaders or whoever to implement some of these things, I'll make sure they're able to contact you that way.
The one, you know, in terms of resources that are accessible, I worked with a company in Australia called Surf Roundtables, and I do some public workshops out there, and I have a business partner in the UK, and he has almost all my papers on his website. So if you're looking for a specific topic, that would be available to download there. His website is www.reliable-manufacturing.com. And the stuff in Australia is www.sirfrt.com.au. So, you know, those are, you know, two public resources of business partners that I work with that have things available on their website. And that's, you know, I'm fine with that.
Excellent. I'll make sure to put links in the show notes so our listeners can just click the link. It'll take them right there. Makes it easy for them to find those.
Okay. Yeah. And if you Google Ron Moore books, you can get access to, you know, all my books, I reckon. There are other Ron Moores out there. Ron Moore is like Jim Smith. It's just a really common name. So you may have to sort just a bit to get the right ones. but I'll leave that to folks out there if they're interested.
Yes, absolutely. And we'll put links to those as well. So, you know, they can click the link, go there directly, make it easy. So they don't have to sort through all that. We'll make it easy.
Yeah.
Well, Ron, I want to thank you for taking the time today to have this conversation on reliability with us. You know, as usual, I always learn something from the people on the show, and it's truly appreciated you sharing your time with us to talk about reliability and all the different aspects of it with us.
Well, it's my pleasure. I hope people can take some of this away and use it effectively to improve their performance. That's always been my objective in doing what I do.
Yes, absolutely. And that's the purpose of the show is, you know, get people to think a little differently, view something differently, and try something. Implement something different. Try the standard work. Focus on 5S. One of those things like you talked about in the basics. Get one of those in place and start moving from there. So, well, thank you, Ron. I appreciate your time, and you have yourself a great day.
Yeah, you too. I'll follow up with I'll send you some of this stuff in an email. So,
excellent. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, James.
Have a
good day.
Bye. You too.
I would like to thank you for listening and remind you that you can always find out more on maintenance, reliability, and asset management at www.iridicio.com and by following our blog. The Rooted in Reliability podcast is a proud member of the Reliability.fm network. I'd like to ask you to please rate and review this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. It ensures the podcast stays relevant and is easy to find by like-minded professionals. It is only with your ratings and reviews that the Rooted in Reliability podcast can continue to grow. I thank you for providing this small but critical support. We'll see you next week when we dive into another burning topic with Rooted in Reliability, your plant performance podcast.